Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest from peterbcollins.com, and I am grateful to the listeners who subscribe in support of this program. Annual subscribers Tom Wilcutz and Catherine Hemness, thank you for renewing. And my thanks to monthly subscribers Jason Ferguson and Wendy Gebauer. I appreciate each and every one of you. In our second segment today, Julia Davis returns. She got fired from Homeland Security for blowing the whistle. And the guy who should have protected her, the whistleblower specialist at the Justice Department, is now in a struggle with her over articles that she's published critical of Scott Block. We'll get the details from Julia Davis coming up in our second segment today. Andy Worthington returns to our program today to update us on the hunger strike at Guantanamo. Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Well, I regard Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, as the gates of hell for the United States, and we have a significant problem there that the Obama administration is playing down, and the corporate media in the United States is cooperating to some extent. Andy Worthington returns to our program. He wrote the book about Guantanamo, Guantanamo Files, and he continues to operate a great website which keeps us abreast of developments there. And he, of course, has personified, helped us understand that there are individual human beings held there, not just, as Don Rumsfeld once said, the worst of the worst. And Andy, thanks as always for the work that you do. And we're seeing a great difference between what you have been reporting for several weeks now about the extent of the participation in a hunger strike at Guantanamo and what the Pentagon admits. And as of this week, as of Monday, the 25th of March, the Pentagon has inched its numbers up, saying that 28 of the 166 inmates at Guantanamo are participating in a hunger strike. But your numbers, which are based on your contacts with the various attorneys who represent those held at Guantanamo, diverge widely from that number.
That's right, yeah. And the attorneys for the prisoners, who were the people who first obviously were able to get the story out, last month, explained from the beginning that this was a huge hunger strike. This was the largest that's been seen at the prison for many, many years. Almost seems very obvious that this is the biggest hunger strike that's taken place since before President Obama became president. And the figures that they were talking about from the beginning were that it was over 100 of the 166 men still held. And there are some claims that it could be as much as 130. Mm-hmm. So it's gigantic. And of course, you know, there are two aspects to why this is happening, Peter. One of which is that there is a regime in place that appears to be to do with the commander of Guantanamo and the latest replacement of the guard force, where what's come about is a very repressive regime in terms of aggressive cell searches and confiscation of prisoners' materials, and them generally being put upon in a really unpleasant manner, and having their copies of the Quran interfered with, which, you know, historically has always been a cause of great problems within the prison itself. But of course, you know, there is a bigger picture here, and the bigger picture here is that it's over 11 years since Guantanamo opened. These were men who, you know, a lot of them jumped up and down for joy when President Obama was elected, and particularly did so when they received the news that he had promised in January 2009 to close the prison within a year. And now they have been completely abandoned by the president. They have also been failed by every other branch of the United States government. But I would think that it's the failure of President Obama that cuts the most deeply. And they very realistically have this feeling that the only way any of them are going to leave Guantanamo is by dying, that the only way out of that wretched place is in a coffin. And, you know, and sadly, the statistics rather tend to back them up. The number of living prisoners leaving Guantanamo in the last few years is almost matched by the numbers of prisoners leaving in coffins.
Yeah. And Andy, the last time we spoke, I made the comment that because the courts have slammed the gates of Guantanamo shut, because the Congress has tied the hands of the president, and because the president lacks any desire to take on the political fight, to do the right thing, that these three factors really have, to borrow a Christian reference to Easter, rolled the stone in front of the tomb. And we don't see any indication that this is going to change anytime soon. And I don't know to what extent our listeners are able to imagine what it would be like to be one of the 166 there, and let's focus on the 86 men who have been cleared for release. Because, as you have pointed out in your coverage and in our comments when I've talked with you, many of these people were cleared for release as long as 6 or 7 years ago by the Bush administration. And they have been reapproved for release by the rather exhaustive effort of a 60-person team of the Obama administration. And so they got clear signals that they were not going to be held forever, that they were cleared of any prospect of being charged or tried. And yet those hopes have now been dashed by the very factors that I just cited.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the inner contradiction within the administration is one that people aren't taking on board. You know, if on the one hand these people aren't being released because somehow there's something troubling about them, they're supposed to be dangerous, then that is completely at odds with the fact that, as you say, under President Bush, but then most particularly under the 60-strong, very sober and responsible collection of government officials who went through their cases in 2009 and recommended them for release. These are at odds with each other. The reason that they were recommended for release out of Guantanamo is because they weren't regarded as significant in any sense. They weren't regarded as a significant security threat or as people who had any intelligence value. It was simply not worth holding on to these people any longer. And yet, that door has been slammed shut by the same administration that said that they could go. Now, that must be awful for the men in question, but that ought to be something that makes American citizens ashamed of the actions of their own government. That you know, this is wrong. It's illogical. It's men's fates having been turned over to part of a game of political maneuvering rather than the attempts at some form of justice, which was what was involved in the first place when the task force came out with its deliberations. Now, you know, I have problems with some of the task force's deliberations, Peter, because they came out with a whole category of 4 dozen prisoners that they said were too dangerous to release, even though the evidence didn't exist to put them on trial. You know, that really sets the alarm bells ringing, and for good reason. It means the government doesn't actually have evidence. Mm-hmm. So holding these people and the president issuing an executive order 2 years ago authorizing their detention is outrageous, and then promising them a review process, which he hasn't even bothered to establish, is doubly outrageous. So that's a whole issue that's also causing problems for the people in Guantanamo. Men who are were told that they were going to be indefinitely detained by the man who said he'd close the prison, and then not given the review process that they were promised. That's bound to annoy them. But it's another aspect of the way the president and his administration are dealing with Guantanamo, which is profoundly wrong. And, you know, the problem, I suppose, that we all have who care about these issues, Peter, is how on earth we managed to get through to the Obama administration. Because all he, the president, seems to care about is that this is a troubling issue that will be difficult to work out. But so long as he's not really getting any political heat for it, he seems content simply not to bother. That although we're trying to push the legacy question that, you know, he will be judged historically on his failure to fulfill his promise, he's still not really that bothered. You know, and that's weakness, I think, from the president of the United States.
Well, let me amplify that, because I think you're being diplomatic there. This is a stunning failure of leadership. And he's had an opportunity to lead since the grandstanding on his first full day in office when he signed that executive order to close Guantanamo. And you can make various excuses. And I recently interviewed Jess Braven, I think you're aware of that, the yeah. Wall Street Journal's Supreme Court reporter, and his new book is called The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo. And he's very polite and diplomatic and doesn't point fingers. But if you read his book, it is quite an indictment of this president who, you know, we all know was a constitutional law instructor at the University of Chicago and who has really repudiated that history of his own by accepting all sorts of compromises that simply are incoherent when it comes to the rule of law. Fundamentally, what Jess Braven writes about is the bankruptcy of the military commission's process. And that's not news to you and me, but he describes this from the point of view of Stu Couch, one of the prosecutors who, like Colonel Morris Davis, a prosecutor, left that post feeling that the process was rigged, that the system did not permit the military lawyers of either side to properly handle these cases and to refuse to take cases that were based on hearsay and evidence derived from torture. And yeah. So let me just offer you a comparison to the domestic political scene right now. The high point of the president's leadership and activism has been on gun regulations. And following the massacre of students and adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut last December, he appeared to be putting a lot of his political capital on the line and was going to push for real change in our gun regulations. And we're already at the stage, just 90 days later, where he and the Democratic leaders in the Senate have capitulated on an assault weapons ban without ever attempting to twist arms and put together the coalition needed to pass it. And right. They're going to settle for background checks and closing of some of the loopholes where people can buy guns at these gun shows. But fundamentally, the NRA, the gun lobby in this country, has already won. And the president wants to find a public relations victory that he can take credit for and then move on to something else. And so I can't let him off the hook on Guantanamo because he made it. You know, I didn't yeah. force this on him. He made it a signature issue. And his point person in the White House, Greg Craig, left after the first year. And you can supply the name of the State Department guy who spent 4 years trying to repatriate many of these men. And he quietly left his post and was not replaced just a couple yeah, of months yeah. ago. What is his name, please?
His name's Daniel Freed.
Freed, right. He is the special envoy at the State Department.
I wouldn't want you to think that I'm letting the president off the hook here, because I absolutely do hold him personally responsible for the post-Bush mess. So, you know, we know he inherited a mess. Early on in his presidency, he told us that he'd inherited a mess and asked for a certain amount of indulgence from us. But he has created his own mess, which I think is much worse in some ways, because it looks as though there is something... there are some legal parameters to it. It looks as though there is some attempt at logic when, you know, this is no way to treat Guantanamo. Guantanamo is the most horrendous legal and moral and ethical abomination. And, you know, and that's what President Obama is still running there. it doesn't matter that, you know, that in some minor ways the treatment of the prisoners has improved. They're still held in a way that ought to appall the conscience of everybody. Imagine if you woke up every morning not knowing if you were ever going to be released, because you're not actually any recognizable form of prisoner. You are still essentially, you know, a nobody lost in a legal black hole. And that's why the president is sitting back, you know, going, oh, I found this rather difficult. But actually, the legislation exists, passed by Congress just after the 9/11 attacks, that authorizes me to detain any of these people that I feel like at Guantanamo for the rest of their lives if I find it difficult not to do anything about it. So that's okay for me. You know, that is really what he said. He's relying on the authorization for use of military force, that dreadful open-ended document passed by Congress 3 days after 9/11 that said the president can go after anybody that he thinks is associated with Al-Qaeda. And then a couple of years later, the Supreme Court in 2004 said, yes, that means detention. Yes, that means you can detain people until the end of hostilities. And we've never moved beyond that, Peter. So, you know, we're not encouraged to ask questions of, hang on a minute, who are these guys? If these guys are criminals, why are they not facing trials in recognizable courts? If these guys are soldiers, why are they not being held as soldiers? Why is it that the president, leaning back there in his chair going, I find it difficult, but I'm legally entitled to do this, isn't facing a challenge from people saying, I don't care whether this looks like it's legal, it's horrible. It always has been horrible, and it always will be horrible until you close the damn place down. So, you know, the failure is on his part. I know he's been he's faced obstruction from Congress, but one of the big obstacles to releasing prisoners from Guantanamo has come from himself. It's come from the ban that he imposed on releasing any of the cleared Yemeni prisoners that his own task force had approved for transfer at Guantanamo when some Nigerian man, apparently recruited in Yemen, tried to blow up a bomb in his underwear on Christmas Day 2009. And recently, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, a meeting was held by this group of American countries that's the only venue that American lawyers can find to at least have discussions about what the United States is doing wrong. The Obama administration sent a State Department representative there, and one of the things that he said while telling the commission that that, you know, everything is lawful at Guantanamo was that the president has no intention of lifting his ban on releasing Yemenis. And, you know, these guys were cleared for release by Obama's own task force, and then the president countermanded that decision because somebody who had had an involvement with Yemen years after these guys were put in prison did something that they didn't like. And now these guys are all held simply on the basis of their nationality alone. And this is supposed to be acceptable year after year after year after year until what? Until they die, Peter. I mean, I'm sure the last time we were talking, we had been talking about the fact that one of them died. This poor man, Adnan Latif, who died there last September.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Andy, I certainly have great compassion for the men at Guantanamo who have found that their only way of expressing their objection to being held in this amoral and indefinite way is to stop accepting food. They have no other recourse. They have no other mechanism at their disposal. And they know that they're putting their own lives on the line. And presumably, if this continues much longer, despite the force feeding, we're going to see these men die from their refusal to accept food. And it will be interesting to see how that is played in the American media, because we've seen the way, for example, in these alleged suicides at Guantanamo, that our media has permitted leaders of the military to say that this is an unfair form of asymmetrical warfare. And that is such a bizarre and irrational statement, but it passes the smell test for far too many Americans.
Sure. And, you know, text from the Department of Defense, who had, you know, been reminded that everyone at Guantanamo is an enemy combatant. You know, this is current language. Now, you know, the president stopped using the words enemy combatant because he realized they were pretty poisonous. But yeah, these people are still fundamentally enemy combatants, and apparently the U.S. Department of Defense still officially considers that that's what they are. Now, an enemy combatant is somebody who only became regarded as such because they happened to fall into the possession of the United States. The very definition of enemy combatant never involved any actual process of establishing that they were. In fact, the, you know, the dark hilarity of the way the Bush administration regarded it as fair to capture people was that it simply captured people, or no, even bought them, or had them, people given to them. It didn't matter how it happened. You end up in U.S. custody, and you are a bad guy. You are an enemy combatant. You have no rights. How did you end up in their possession? It doesn't matter. The mere fact of ending up in U.S. custody meant that you were an enemy combatant. That is, you know, that is almost beyond the reach of the kind of worst kind of totalitarian regime that you could think of. This stuff is happening. This stuff is still happening. This is effectively how it is. So, yeah, we've got the men risking their lives. We have to hope that the repercussions from that somehow affect the way that the administration thinks about it, the way the president thinks about it, the way the American people think about it. Now, you know, I was watching a brief clip on RT just today, actually. This was a broadcast that I think went out yesterday, where they went out in the streets of New York and asked a number of ordinary citizens, do you know that of the prisoners in Guantanamo, over half of them were cleared for release by the government but are still held, and people didn't. And they were troubled by it. You know, these were ordinary people. They haven't been briefed by their media or by their government, so they hadn't heard about it. They haven't, as many people have, thankfully, gone looking on the internet to find information. They simply accepted what they were told or not told, and were then presented with this information. And they all followed up by saying, that's quite shocking, actually. How can that be? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're up against this kind of entrenched ignorance, Peter, which is, you know, which is deeply frustrating. And again, it's part of the problem with President Obama, because he's the president of the United States. It was his job to stand up and tell the American people what was and what wasn't true when it came to this. And after that, you know, that very first and second day of the things that he did and his executive order promising to close Guantanamo, nothing. We've had nothing. No leadership at all.
Now, Andy, I'm sure you've followed these events, but in early March, things reached a climax as the administration was pushing for the confirmation of John Brennan to move from the White House back to the CIA as the top spook. And I am pleased that there was some debate, that Senator Rand Paul, who is not somebody I support on most issues, spoke up, and he challenged the president's power to target and kill individuals. His focus was on Americans in the United States and didn't go too much beyond that. But I give Senator Paul credit for raising an important set of issues and provoking some conversation and commentary about that. Well, in short order, Brennan was confirmed, and then almost within 24 hours, it was announced that we had received the son-in-law of Osama bin Laden. His name is Abu Ghaith, and he had been living in Iran. They kicked him out. He went to Turkey. It appears they booted him out. He landed in Jordan, friendly to the United States. So the president visited there on his Middle East tour last week. And Jordan, known for a heavy hand in interrogation, at least in the past, held on to him for an unclear period of time. It seemed to be maybe a week or two. And then suddenly, the son-in-law of Osama bin Laden, it's announced, is being held in a jail in New York City and was arraigned in the federal courtroom where they had intended to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four alleged accomplices for trial until Eric Holder was forced to back down by a combination of Mayor Bloomberg and Democratic leaders, along with a chorus of Republicans. So I found it interesting because, as a sharp critic of what I used to call the president's kill or kill program, they actually captured somebody, didn't simply dispatch him with a drone strike, produced him in relatively broad daylight on American soil in New York City instead of sending him to Guantanamo. So all of those factors struck me as, whoa, Maybe they are changing their tune, and maybe they're trying to expand the latitude that they have given the various factors that have reined them in. So from your perspective in jolly old England, what did you see in that sequence of events, and did it give you any sense that maybe some things are changing?
Well, you know, I think first of all, you know, when we talk about the administration and the government, you know, it's clear that there are different forces working within those organizations. There is dissent, there is argument. They are trying to reach conclusions that they're happy with. And it's part of the reason there's been such a mess, because there isn't really any joined up thinking. But certainly one of the things that certain people within the administration are concerned about is the absolutely shredded legitimacy of the military commission trial system at Guantanamo. You know, now the history of that is that, you know, these were brought back from the dead by Dick Cheney, that the Supreme Court ruled them illegal in 2006. Congress then brought them back to life and invented war crimes that could be tried. And President Obama, when he came in, actually the first thing that he did was to suspend them while he investigated them. But he then came back and said, no, we're going to do them. We're just going to make them better. Congress is helping us out. And they've been a very poor substitute for federal court trials in terms of legitimacy. Federal court trials have their own problems in that it's actually absurdly easy for people to lose their entire lives in prison for something that they either didn't do or that was incredibly insignificant. There's a massive, you know, sentencing problem in federal courts. But at least they don't have the problem that the military commissions have, that their legitimacy just doesn't really exist. And the most ironic thing really happened, Peter, at the end of last year and the start of this year, which is that conservative judges in the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., kicked out the rulings against two of the only prisoners to have been tried by military commission, and said, well, no, you know, they were tried for crimes that were not war crimes at the time that the legislation was passed, and effectively, you know, said these are not war crimes, you know, which was what sober and intelligent people had been saying all along about this. So my feeling was that, you know, there are elements obviously within the government, within the Justice Department, I would think, that are aware that that maybe the, you know, the military commissions can't limp on forever, and if that's the case, then to avoid you know, an indefinite detention scenario, which is actually what exists for everybody at Guantanamo at the moment. But say you did want to proceed with trials, then maybe they need to find a way to get federal courts back in the picture. But I mean, it must also be said, Peter, that throughout this whole ridiculous nonsense of the war on terror and the terrible super terrorists that have been held at Guantanamo and how they must never be allowed to have trials, you know, all through that period, under President Bush as well as under President Obama, people accused of terrorism have been tried in federal courts in the United States, you know, without you know, planes flying into buildings and all the kind of nonsense that was conjured up when there was that horrible, cynical opposition to trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York. So, you know, there is a precedent for federal court trials. There is also, I think, that the administration is perhaps looking for a way out of trials at Guantanamo, possibly, or some elements of the administration are. Whether this man is going to get a fair trial or not, I don't know, Peter. But you know, but it was reassuring to see something that at least the parameters in which this man was being tried were not hysterical. This was just a man accused of some involvement in terrorism, being put in a courtroom, and off we go with the process that we all recognize. And that's what we desperately need with Guantanamo on every level, is to scale down the absurd rhetoric about everybody. Because fundamentally, that's really the problem we have. We have all these insignificant people in Guantanamo, Peter. These nobodies approved for transfer. They're not going to approve people for transfer at Guantanamo if they're any kind of threat. These are nobodies. But, you know, but in the way that Guantanamo is manipulated by those who support it, and who support it for the worst reasons, because they can't wait to find an excuse to put more people in there, the way they see it, they ramp up the significance of everybody. So nobody's become terrorists. And people accused of terrorism become super terrorists of a kind that nobody had ever conceived of before. You know, the greatest existential threat in the whole of history. It's absurd. You know, I don't know why more of the American people don't go, you know, I get the feeling that the rest of the world is laughing at us. Why is that? Because actually, outside America, there are a lot of us who think that this kind of fear-mongering and the way that people fall for it is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, and Andy, just to compound this, at a time of extreme budget duress here in the United States and this across-the-board cut that is hitting some essential services, at least it's threatening to at this point, we have the request from the Pentagon for nearly $200 million in new construction at Guantanamo. And the number crept up from 150 to nearly 200 last week after General John Kelly, who is the commander of SOUTHCOM, apparently wasn't clear on what was secret and what isn't. And in his public comments, he acknowledged the existence of Camp 7. And then kind of backed off from that. We'll say, well, maybe I wasn't supposed to say that. At any rate, $200 million to add a new Camp 7. And Jess Braven told me about the facilities there that have pods for six defendants. But, of course, there are only five remaining in the KSM trial. And they've already wasted massive amounts of money to create the venues for these political show trials. And yet they want to sink more money into this, you know, where we pretend that this is offshore and out of reach of American courts, even though that has been pretty well refuted. And just a final quote from General Kelly. He said, everything that's built down there is at least twice as expensive. And so here we have all of these deficit hawks in the United States saying we got to cut, cut, cut. Oh, but not at Guantanamo.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the sad thing about that is that, you know, this shouldn't really just be about the money. But of course, you know, it's absurd to be throwing away tens of millions of dollars as is happening. But, you know, what the bit that I would focus on this is that, you know, I have no doubt, Peter, that the facilities at Guantanamo, you know, are wearing out and that they would need to be replaced if these people are going to be held. So, you know, it's about 18 months ago that Carol Rosenberg in the Miami Herald first exposed the cost of holding prisoners at Guantanamo. You know, my take on that was to add up the cost of holding these cleared prisoners. Now, nearly all of the people that we spoke about, the 86 men, it wasn't much different from that a year and a half ago. And at that time, it was costing $72 million a year to hold people that the United States said that it didn't want to hold. So we've got that $72 million a year. That's ongoing. Every year, that is what is being paid to hold people that the United States government said it wanted to release. Well, now we've got $200 million for the renewal of the facilities at Guantanamo. We've got General Kelly inadvertently letting slip that there's a $50 million facility that's going to replace Camp 7, which is where, my understanding is, 16 high-value detainees are held. And then we've got 150 for new buildings and the maintenance of and the people required to look after and work there for the other prisoners. So over half the prisoners are cleared for release. That's another, I would say, that's about $80 million on top of the $72 million that it's costing every year to build new facilities to hold men that the United States government doesn't want to hold. So let's say that we include that in the budget for this year, Peter. That's $150 million this year that the United States is spending at Guantanamo to hold prisoners that it doesn't want to hold. When is somebody going to address this? When is the president going to address this and do something about it? Because, you know, you add that to the injustice of holding men that you said you didn't want to hold. It's just another layer of injustice and ridiculousness. And surely, you know, savings need to be made at some point that are actually easy savings to make. And this really ought to be the case, I think.
Well, and we can't anticipate that there will be any discussion with the president on this because he is rarely asked about these issues. He holds fewer news conferences than even George W. Bush did. And when he does, only five or six questions are asked. He gives extremely long answers. Some of those are interesting long answers, but still, it cuts down the number of topics that come up. And no corporate media reporter who has White House press credentials has decided that Guantanamo is more important than a current budget battle or the gun legislation or some of the other topics that tend to dominate these carefully orchestrated press appearances. And while we heard that in some of the private meetings with members of Congress, that Senator Rockefeller and perhaps Senator Wyden raised questions about the president's authority to kill people, we have not heard anything leak that anybody from anywhere has asked him about Guantanamo. And so he knows that it's a low priority in political terms and is able to finesse these issues and just ignore them. And it appears that the death of one or more hunger strikers may be the necessary trigger to force him to confront his own failures.
Well, I think my only hope going forward from this point, Peter, with this hunger strike raging, and sadly the possibility that people will die, is that the information that something is happening at Guantanamo can very easily be accompanied by people finding out these disturbing facts about over half the prisoners being cleared for release, which I think is the most significant one. You can then break it down into who are they, why are they held, and then you find out about this whole problem of holding Yemenis. But essentially, this fact that RT took out into the New York streets and shocked ordinary Americans with, over half the guys at Guantanamo are people the government doesn't want to hold but's holding. If the hunger strike stays, if people stay focused on it, I think that this may surface and then may become something that that would inspire people to be upset about it. I certainly hope so, Peter. I can't imagine what else we're going to do if people aren't going to get upset about this, because the principle of using Guantanamo for fear-mongering and to encourage people not to look at what is happening there is that, we're not supposed to have gone beyond the Rumsfeld, the worst of the worst thing. Mm-hmm. You aren't supposed to investigate it. You're supposed to trust that your government, like a good father, is looking after you and keeping you safe from these scary terrorists that are all banged up at Guantanamo. Now, that's patently not true, as we know. But if there's an actual spur to encouraging people to understand that something is wrong with this picture, then surely, as these people are on a hunger strike, it has to be that the reason that many of these people are on a hunger strike was because they were told they were going home years ago, and yet they're still held. It's got to be.
Well, and Andy, I don't know about you, but one time many years ago when I was hospitalized after a car accident, they put a feeding tube up my nose and down my throat for a couple of days. And it was the most uncomfortable thing that I have ever endured. And I think there are people who hear that we're force-feeding these hunger strikers, and they say, oh, that's okay. And I have to presume that those people have never suffered through the insertion of a feeding tube. Now, I did it voluntarily. Still, my gag reflex has kicked in. And at one point, I when they were inserting it, I actually just recoiled and pulled it out of my nose. If you're being shackled and forced to submit to the insertion of a feeding tube, it's extremely painful. And as you've pointed out in your coverage, this is considered a violation of international law.
Yeah, sure. And, when news of this first started to come out, Peter, and I heard about the military's and the establishment and the government's first denials about it, when they said nobody is on a hunger strike apart from the five or six long-term hunger strikers. Now, I know that there have been a small number of people persistently on a hunger strike, but my thoughts immediately went out to at least two of those guys that I know about, who, as far as I'm aware, Peter, have been on a hunger strike since 2005. So imagine that. Every day, these guys are force-fed in the way that you describe, the pain of having to put up with that for 2 days. They've been going through this. They're in their eighth year. You know, it's extraordinary. And the second thing that I thought is, I don't like to hear about a lot of these guys going on a prolonged hunger strike, because if you or I were to go on a hunger strike, you know, I dare say it would take some time before we started to look, you know, worryingly thin. The issue with the prisoners in Guantanamo is that, with the exception of a few people with weight issues, I know that there are a few obese prisoners in Guantanamo, but the majority of the prisoners in Guantanamo are not. Mm-hmm. You know, I think across the board, the general physique of people in Guantanamo is worryingly thin, and it always has been the case. So, you know, when you're aware of that, instead of the lies that, you know, Republican lawmakers would always go there and say, hey, these guys are all so, they're eating so much, you know, it's a lie. They're so thin anyway that you start thinking about them losing weight. You start imagining what it's like that, you know, that this prison that the United States, you know, doesn't want anyone to know about what's happening there. Why would that be? Could it be because this prison is populated with all these people who can't tell you why they're held? The government can't actually legitimately explain why they're held. And you know what? A lot of these guys weigh 100 pounds or less. Think about that. You know, if we ever got the pictures out, Peter, you know, nobody has ever leaked pictures of Guantanamo. I was thinking, with the recent anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, how powerful those photos from Abu Ghraib were in terms of exposing abuse. But no pictures have ever been leaked by anybody who's worked with the United States of you know, prisoners in Guantanamo, you know, at their most desperate. It's just shocking. It's so shocking.
Andy, I wanted to ask you about three individuals who have an interesting track record of liberal-leaning politics and policies, who were appointed to key posts by President Obama and appear to have changed. And the first is Jeh Johnson. His first name is J-E-H. He left his position as the chief counsel at the Pentagon last December. And he has given some interesting speeches in the interim, one questioning just how long this open-ended war will go on, and therefore these rules of detention will remain in effect. He also has raised some interesting questions in a recent speech at Fordham University about the proposal for a kill court, an execution court, like the FISA court, where the president could go secretly and reliably to get a death warrant, which would provide a modest paper trail as compared to the way they're doing it now. Yeah. Well, in Jess Braven's book, he depicts Jeh Johnson as the most aggressive defender of the military commissions. And so I asked him, I said, who is the real Jeh Johnson? And it kind of provoked a chuckle from Braven. But when you see these people who have at least some liberal statements, I don't want to characterize him. I don't know Jeh Johnson, but he has made some comments that are at least more constitutional than what we think of the policies as. Yet his actions, when he worked at the Pentagon, were very much contradictory to some of the statements that he's recently made.
Well, you know, I was interested in his recent statements about, you know, is there an end to this war on terror? I thought that was very significant. I hope that it did indicate that these things are being talked about. What I know primarily about him is that when the military commissions were being revised by the Obama administration, he was one of the officials who told Congress, please don't include material support for terrorism as a crime, because it's not a recognized war crime, and they ignored him. And that's the, you know, that eventually was what the appeals court, the very conservative appeals court in Washington, D.C., decided. Mm-hmm. So Jeh Johnson was right. So on what level he was defending the military commissions. He may have been defending them on a basis that hadn't really been worked out. Maybe it just went with the job spec. You know, if you're the senior lawyer at the Pentagon, what does the Pentagon do? Well, one of the things it does apparently is run these military trials at Guantanamo, which we're trying to get right. I don't know. I mean, for me, the problem is that, you know, if you don't leave the Obama administration, you know, then it means that you have no principles. Surely, you know, I'm not across the board on all issues, but specifically to do with all the things to do with national security and America's military power and everything that Obama has either carried on from Bush or has initiated himself. You know, these things ought to be deeply troubling to people who take their position responsibly and who understand what the law is or should be. So, you know, I'm much more in a position of understanding when people leave the administration, Peter, and not knowing how people can stay on. My feeling is that when people stay on in somewhere where there are fundamental problems, it requires them to change who they are.
All right, let me float one other name here, Neil Katyal, a Georgetown University law professor who aggressively provided legal counsel and defense to some of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, joined the Obama administration and was for a time the deputy solicitor general. And I'm not trying to judge these men by remote control, but I expected that he might have a positive effect. And putting people like Katyal and Harold Koh at the State Department, who had a history of advocacy for human rights and criticism of breaches of those rights, when we put these three together, Johnson, Katyal, and Koh, they represented the best hope of moderating the extremism was there when Obama took over. But we've seen such great continuity, and we've seen the fingerprints of these people who we thought might be different on many of the extended policies that started under Bush.
Yeah, well, you know, and then also, you know, what happened to Attorney General Eric Holder? You know, the man who told Jane Mayer that, you know, that this administration would be judged in how it handled the 9/11 trial. You know, this was before his president said, oh, actually, it's become a bit inconvenient. We're not going to have that trial in New York after all. You know, what happened to Eric Holder, the man who, you know, was personally appalled by what he had heard about the Bush administration's torture program and very much came across as somebody who was going to investigate that properly? You know, this is the same Eric Holder who eventually presided over yet another feeble whitewash in which, you know, nobody got touched for anything. Nobody was held accountable for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is just what happens. I mean, you know, I've heard about Harold Koh having his misgivings. But like I say, the only way I can really judge these things, Peter, is when people leave. You know, Greg Craig was pushed out of his job, from what I understand. But, you know, Greg Craig was the great champion to me in that first year of Obama's presidency, of having been the person who pushed for those executive orders, who then, you know, when General Hayden, who was at the time the head of the CIA, rang up when President Obama had unclassified some of the torture documents, the key torture documents, one of John New's torture memos and other documents, when those had been released and Hayden had rung up saying, you know, how dare you give help to America's enemies? You know, apparently it was Craig who said, well, because the president has said that we don't do this stuff anymore, so there are no more secrets to hide. You know, he was kicked out of the government within a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I respected him as I do other people that I've heard about over the years who have left. It seems to me that it's not possible to stay within this administration and retain your integrity. So, you know, broadly speaking, Peter, that may just be an issue about what happens with politics and power, because, you know, we have a problem, I think, with politics and power in general, that, you know, it's extremely hard to get governments to do the right thing. But, yeah, you know, I can't see how anyone could stay in the government with the mess that Obama has made of things.
Andy Worthington, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks again for the work you do. exposing the underbelly of America's barbaric system here and working so hard to change it. I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you very much, Peter, and it's been a great pleasure talking to you as always.
Julia Davis returns to our program today. She was a candidate for the FBI, was working for the Department of Homeland Security way back in the dark ages of the Bush administration. And around the 4th of July one year, I place it as about 2004, and Julia can correct me if my memory is off, but she reported some unusual activity at the border crossing between Mexico and the United States. And when her boss ignored her, she followed procedure, notified the FBI, which in turn appeared to embarrass Homeland Security. They retaliated against her in just an incredible way, punctuated by every element in the Patriot Act, going through bank records, tailing them. And then when the black helicopter arrived and disgorged more than 25 SWAT-type troops at one of her and her husband's homes, it just makes for a story that is unbelievable, except that it's all true. Julia, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. And your memory was exactly correct. You got the date right.
Okay, well, it's been a while since I reviewed your case. And in the meantime, a final edition of the documentary film, The Terror Within, has been released. It's available now on DVD. And I'm going to put up a link in the show file at peterbcollins.com to topprioritymovie.com, where people can get a copy. And if you just heard me recap her story and you think I'm full of it, well, I have an email address, fullofit@peterbcollins.com, and you're welcome to use it and tell me why you think I am. But first, I encourage you to watch this documentary film, because it is hair-raising and just amazing to see the amounts of money and the levels that our government would go to silence a whistleblower. And you refuse to be silenced, Julia. You're now, among other things, working as an investigative reporter. And one of the people you have written about is retaliating against you. So this is kind of a cycle that unfortunately has defined your life in recent years.
Yes, very true, Peter. Interestingly enough, I had first come across Scott Bloch, who is a former head of the Office of Special Counsel, the agency that is supposed to protect whistleblowers. I first came across that agency when I had submitted my report of retaliation to them, and my attorney warned me right away. He said, don't expect them to take any action. All they're going to do is they're going to reject your complaint, and they will tell you that no investigation is necessary, and they will close your case, and then you move on to the next step. And I thought it was so unbelievable, because I was telling him, but I have all the evidence. I have all these documents that I'll be submitting. And he told me, you wait and see. The OSC is useless. Sure enough, when I submitted my complaint, it was never investigated. I received a letter of refusal to investigate from Scott Bloch. And later on, this same guy had pleaded guilty to actually deleting several hundred, as far as I remember, it was over 400 whistleblower complaints from government computers in order to make it look like they were so efficient in processing cases. So cases like mine were simply wiped out from OSC's computers. He had actually hired a firm called Geeks on Call to conduct a seven-layer scrub of the computers so nothing would be traceable or retrievable. And he simply deleted whistleblower cases. And so I started watching this guy very closely and reporting on different steps in his legal process, and I found it very curious that Department of Justice prosecutors that were supposed to be representing the public and prosecuting this guy for variety of his heinous crimes. That was only one of them, what I mentioned. He was also retaliating against his own employees and denying people protection from discrimination based on sexual orientation, because this guy is a real bigot, and he calls homosexuals sexual perverts. Mm-hmm. So there was a variety of hideous things that he was doing. But it was appalling to me that the prosecutors kept supporting all of his motions when he was sentenced to 30 days in prison, but he didn't want to serve it. He alleged that he didn't understand that the crime he pleaded guilty to could lead to prison term. And even though he's been an attorney since the 80s, so if anyone understands the terms of a guilty plea to a certain crime, a lawyer does understand it, but yet prosecutors supported him, and he managed to get that conviction and guilty plea thrown out. So now he pleaded guilty to a smaller crime and is about to be resentenced in May of this year.
Mm-hmm. And so, Julia, I want to get more detail on the spat that you're having with Scott Block. But before we get too far into this, I just want to affirm what you have said about the failure of the Office of Special Counsel to represent whistleblowers in any meaningful way. And I want to point out that a longtime listener and a subscriber to this program named Joe Carson, who works for the Department of Energy and is one of the most successful whistleblowers in recent American history, has written about this at great length. And he, if you Google Joe Carson and Broken Covenant, he talks about the obscure agency that reports to the OSC, which is called the Merit Service Protections Board. And it is supposed to protect people like you and other whistleblowers from prohibited personnel practices, PPP. And Joe Carson has tirelessly written to every newly appointed federal official in the Justice Department or the White House, trying to get them to simply honor the law. This goes back to civil service reform in the late 1970s. There was an attempt to recover from the Watergate crimes. And so what he points out in his terminology of broken covenant is that ever since 1978 or so, when the law was modified, the Justice Department has essentially just refused to follow the law. And they're supposed to file a report every year about who has asked for whistleblower protection and what the disposition of those cases has been. And even as in as simple a task as just reporting data, the Office of Special Counsel and this Merit Service Protection Board have continued to defy the law. And so I just want to underscore what you said, because there's a chance, maybe it's a long shot, that a whistleblower is listening to this podcast and thinking, oh, I've got protections under law. I can go to the Justice Department, and they're going to protect me from the retaliation that I'm facing from a government agency. And if I learned anything from your case, it's that this has expanded into this newly created Department of Homeland Security, and that they basically have cracked down on whistleblowers at the same in the same manner as other agencies have in the past. And there's one more thing I'd like to ask your view on related to the Office of Special Counsel and whistleblowers, and that is the posture of the Obama administration. Because this president has cracked down on whistleblowers, not only Bradley Manning, not only Thomas Drake from the NSA, but and he's invoked the an arcane law from the 1920s, the Espionage Act, to really at least threaten to throw the book at whistleblowers, instead of saying, here's somebody who came forward and who is reporting wrongdoing. This is someone we should protect, and this is information we should use to prosecute those who have committed criminal behavior. So, Julia Davis, what is your take on Barack Obama in terms of how he handles whistleblowing?
I think it's hypocrisy at its worst, and I think it's appalling that non-government organizations such as Project on Government Oversight had actually given him an award for being such a great whistleblower protector, and I think they called it a transparency award, when he has prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other president in American history. So it's disgraceful.
It certainly is. Now, coming back to what's going on with you and Scott Block, and by the way, if people want to look him up, he spells his name B-L-O-C-H. And his history, as you pointed out, is that he's one of the evangelicals who was brought into government during the Bush administration. And he was fairly reliable in doing the bidding of the White House, particularly when it came to protecting Karl Rove. And one of the cases that we've covered in depth on my programs, Julia, is the railroading of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman into federal prison, where he sits today. And that was a wrongful conviction in more than two dozen different ways. And the Bush administration succeeded in blocking any efforts by the Congress to ask questions of Karl Rove under oath about the appointment of U.S. attorneys, about his specific potential role in the Siegelman investigation. And so Scott Block ran interference for many of the dark deeds that occurred under President Bush. And as you pointed out, you described him as a bigot. He's a homophobe. And he, when he took over at, he was first in the Justice Department's faith-based initiative. Then they moved him over to the OSC. And one of the first things he did was try to say that homosexuals did not have any protection from wrongful retaliation or treatment by their government superiors. And the White House was forced to change his policy, and they issued a minor reprimand. But you are correct in saying that he is a man who believes, I guess, that his faith permits him to discriminate against even people who are working for him in an office that is supposed to protect the rights of federal workers. It is simply contradictory. And these are the kind of people who I call members of the wrecking crew. When a Republican administration in particular appoints people to an office or a task that they are diametrically or philosophically opposed to. And I think that that defines Scott Block quite well in terms of his role when he worked at the Justice Department.
Yes, Peter, it definitely does. And for years now, every time I would post an article about him, I believe Scott Block himself would post anonymous comments on my Facebook page and also on my Examiner page, and he would claim in there that about himself, he was saying that he was literally, I'm using his quote verbatim, saying that he was poked at, harassed, hounded, abused, and driven into a dubiously objective conviction of contempt of Congress by the homosexual, bisexual, and other perverse, sexually oriented special interests. So he has obviously been reading my articles, because I don't see who else would refer to it in this way, because those are all his own words he had used in other contexts before. So apparently now this year he decided that only commenting on my articles was not enough, and he decided to try to get them removed from the internet altogether.
Now this effort at intimidation by Scott Block, who is still a practicing attorney despite his guilty pleas, and he, as you point out, is awaiting sentencing in a little over a month from now, but this is rich with irony, contradiction, and outright hypocrisy. Because, and correct me if I've mischaracterized this, Julia Davis, but he is objecting to articles that you have written which accurately accuse him of misusing the name and likeness of a whistleblower from the war in Iraq. And he, you have exposed that he appropriated the picture and the story of Preston Wheeler. And Wheeler was working for KBR as a truck driver in Iraq, and he made a video recording of an incident that certainly embarrassed his employers, and also he accused the military escort of abandoning him in a firefight in Iraq. And so he has this man, Preston Wheeler, has a claim to a certain level of heroism and honesty for taking on a big outfit like KBR and the military. But Scott Block has never represented Preston Wheeler. And from what we can tell, there is no connection between Preston Wheeler and Scott Block. Yet on Scott Block's website, he has, for over a year and a half, featured a picture of Preston Wheeler, used his story as a way to promote his legal services to whistleblowers. And so you expose this, which is probably a minor crime, but is nonetheless criminal behavior, and he responds by sending a bogus threatening letter to you, demanding that you pull down articles that you have written about him, in particular, this case, the Wheeler case that I'm referring to. And he has no basis in law to do this. He's a public figure, and he can't change that, all right? He served in government, and he doesn't meet any standard of a private citizen. And it's also fair to say, in my own opinion, that you are not attacking him with quote-unquote reckless disregard for the truth. You have a respect for the truth. And so I'm going to stop talking and ask you to comment on this, because I just find this unbelievable that he would attempt to use his legal stationery and throw his weight around in order to intimidate you from exposing his own ethical misdeeds.
Yes, it is completely outrageous, and I've actually interviewed the person in question, the contractor whose name he's been using, Preston Wheeler, who told me he's always been represented by a different attorney, and they had actually sent Scott Block a formal legal demand to remove his picture and to stop mentioning his case. And right underneath his picture, Scott Block wrote, "I love representing heroes." So, you know, it's a very blatant misrepresentation. And now I also find out that apparently there's a picture of another contractor whose name is John Woodson that also may be there fraudulently. I'm trying to confirm that right now. But Scott Block apparently figured out that there's a lot of money to be made by suing big companies on behalf of contractors and whistleblowers. So he's trying to entice new clients by using and misusing their names fraudulently. And, of course, as his own letter threatening litigation says, he says that my articles are damaging his ability to get new clients and damaging his business as a law firm. So, therefore, he decided that he could just threaten me to get them removed, and that's definitely contrary to the First Amendment right, as well as anti-SLAPP laws that specifically prevent any journalists or writers, anyone who is reporting factual events from being sued for it. So,
And Julia, let's just define what a SLAPP suit is, because not everybody understands. It's S-L-A-P-P. I don't recall what the letters stand for, but this is when a powerful entity files a bogus legal documents or makes a threatening, takes a threatening legal posture towards somebody in an effort to intimidate them and to stop them from simply telling the truth, right?
Exactly, and it's the SLAPP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation.
Thank you.
That tries to censor or intimidate any reporters from criticizing public figures.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this is almost comical. On his Law Office of Scott J. Block letterhead, he leads off his letter in bold underline saying confidential, not for publication. Who does he think he is? He can just decree that a bogus threatening letter aimed at you is not for publication? I mean, come on. That is just breathtaking.
It is. It's completely laughable. And in response to his letter, I also sent him a letter, and I said that in your communication, you're claiming that there are falsehoods in my article. I demand that you point out what those falsehoods are, and otherwise I will expect a public retraction that is sent to anyone and everyone whom you had contacted about my articles, trying to get them removed from the internet. And there has been no response to my letter, of course.
Mm-hmm. And, Julia, you got a letter from Scott Block. This, I'm guessing, would have been, what, about 2006 or 2007? Explain the correspondence that you had with his office while he was running the OSC, the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel.
His response simply said that the OSC decided not to investigate my complaint and the case is hereby closed. So that was the extent of it. But since he was so prominent within the Bush administration, and since such high levels of the government were involved in sending a Black Hawk to my house and arranging a raid, you know, it takes a lot more than just the local authorities to organize something of that magnitude, and 2 years of surveillance and so many agents that were paid overtime to travel to our home and follow us around. I suspect that he had heard of me in other ways from his loyal, you know, Bushies that he apparently continues to run with. So I think that it has more than one meaning for him. I'm sure he has probably heard of me and probably even more outraged that a whistleblower over whom he exercised some semblance of control in the past as far as not investigating my case, that I'm now daring to expose him. So I'm sure that's getting under his skin even more. And he actually wanted people to pay for his legal defense when he was charged with crimes that he pleaded guilty to. That's one of the articles I wrote about that has him the most upset. Is Block set up a fund for donations for other people to pay for his legal defense for the crimes that he pleaded guilty to. It's just outrageous. This guy has no shame.
Yeah, yeah. That part is very clear. Now, one of the things that you point out in a recent article that you wrote, Julia Davis, is that he is going to face a court for sentencing in early May related to his, revised guilty plea, and that anyone who has been on the receiving end of Scott Block's actions at the OSC has the right to submit a victim impact statement. So I will post the address in the show file related to this podcast at peterbcollins.com so that if you're in that position and you wish to write such a letter, you have the information that you need. Julia, I can imagine that you have or will write a letter like that. What would you say to the judge about Scott Block?
One important thing that I want to point out to anyone who might submit a victim impact statement, I had made that mistake as well as many other whistleblowers during Block's previous sentencing, and that is by mentioning third parties that were involved in our cases, which I'm sure everyone had many other people involved. But what we are only able to mention things that have to do with us personally without mentioning anyone else's name. So it has to be the whistleblower's name, and the Scott Block's name and information should only figure in that letter, because the last time all of the whistleblower victim impact letters were kicked off the record simply because they mentioned third parties.
Okay,
so
that's a great tip.
This time,
thank you.
Hopefully, we will all do it right, and the letters will actually end up on the record. And what I'm going to say is that Scott Block could have prevented what happened to me, including such outrageous retaliation, two false imprisonments. If the OSC investigated my allegations it would have never gotten to the raid of my house that caused the death of my father or the death of our neighbor and two other witnesses. So it all snowballed in the huge chain of events. And if the OSC functioned the way it's supposed to, all of those activities could have been caught and nipped in the bud very early on. And because of their failure to take any action, it had turned into a horrific ordeal for me, and I'm sure for hundreds of other whistleblowers whose cases were destroyed and never investigated.
Yeah. And the other thing to point out is that your original action that led to this massive retaliation effort was an attempt to protect us from what you thought was a potential terrorist threat. And so to see that be turned on its head, and somehow you are worse than a terrorist, because we don't know of anybody in the United States who has been subjected to the kind of police activities that were aimed at you, including that black helicopter raid. And it is appropriate to mention that your elderly father was at the scene when these stormtroopers arrived, and they held him outdoors in the heat without his medication, and he died shortly thereafter. So it's not at all a stretch to link his death to this abuse of authority on the part of our government against an honest employee who was trying to do her job and protect our border, which last time I heard is a very high priority of our government.
Exactly, Peter. And instead of worrying about our security, they have declared Julia Davis their top priority, which they testified to under oath. And they had actually utilized more manpower and spent more time raiding my house than in the operation against bin Laden. There were less people involved, and they spent less time raiding his compound than they did of my house. And they had the audacity to call me a domestic terrorist. So the irony is overwhelming.
It certainly is. Well, Julia, it's great to talk with you again. Is there anything you want to add about this exchange with Scott Block?
Just asking for people to please get involved, because our voices are all we have. And if you are a whistleblower or you know a whistleblower, please Google the case or go to Peter's website and look up the links. And get involved. Let the word spread so that whistleblowers may participate in this sentencing, and that the word gets out. And that's the only thing we can do to prevent criminals like Scott Block from getting away with crimes.
Julia, you warm my heart. You're a principled fighter, and we need more people like you in these dark days in America right now.
Thank you, Peter, and the same for you. Thank you for telling it like it is and always reporting the truth.
Look, in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. No, it's a black helicopter from the United States government.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.